So, wow, actually have some time today. This is great. I want to talk about a topic today. If you'll turn back to 2 Corinthians 2, let's start back here and discuss an important topic today that I think we need to be reminded of a lot, because I think we kind of grow maybe callous towards it, or we stop realizing this is the reality of the situation, or what's actually going on. And we see in 2 Corinthians 2, let's start in verse 10. I'm just breaking completely in the middle of a thought here. I'm not going to go through the actual story, but this is where, if you remember, in 1 Corinthians, they had put somebody out of the church because of a sin that he was doing. And then this is the, you know, here's what we should do about that. Starting verse 10, it says, "Now whom you forgive anything, I also forgive," talking about forgiving that person they put out of the church. "For if indeed I have forgiven anything," 2 Corinthians 2, verse 10, "I have forgiven anything, I have forgiven that one for your sakes in the presence of Christ, lest," and this is the chapter or the verse I want to hone in on, verse 11, "lest Satan should take advantage of us, for we are not ignorant of his devices." And the question I want to pose to us today is that, are we actually ignorant of his devices? And I'd like to talk about today some of Satan's devices. And while there's 1,000 scriptures on this subject, I'm only going to use a few that I think are particularly relevant today, or apropos to the things that we experience in life today. Now, the word devices there, "we are not ignorant of his devices," is a Greek word that basically means a number of things. It's translated different ways. Sometimes it's translated mind. Device is only translated that way one time, and then it's translated thought. So it's a mental perception, a thought, an evil purpose, that which thinks, the mind, the thoughts, or the purposes. So what he's saying here is we're not ignorant of his thoughts, his purposes, his techniques, and the things that he does on us. Now, when he says we're not ignorant of that, I guess I'm proposing to you today that we should ask ourselves, are we ignorant of his devices? I think we need to take a look at that and say, have we become kind of maybe just complacent, that when we see these things and there are devices there, that we are kind of ignorant of them? And let's understand why, though, why this is. So I want to step through a few devices, and I'm only going to cover a few. I want to cover some background principles to these scriptures, but I also want to cover basically three devices if we have time to do that. Now, the first thing to notice about this in talking about this subject is, let's turn over to Ephesians 6. Because Ephesians 6 lays a very important piece of groundwork for us, that we read that and we say, yeah, okay, I know that, but do we recognize it in the reality of situations? Ephesians 6. Ephesians 6, verse 10 through 12 is what we'll read. It says, "Finally, my brethren," starting in verse 10, "be strong in the Lord and the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil." And the wiles, again, is the same kind of a concept there. It's his techniques, his things. It's translated a couple of ways. One time it's translated lie in wait, like wile, somebody lying in wait for you. It's translated wile. It's also kind of has the intent meaning of, you know, cunning arts, deceit, craft, trickery, kind of scheming. So when it says there that, you know, that you'll be able to stand against his wiles, it's saying that our enemy actually operates on kind of an unfair way, a tricky kind of manipulative way is what that's saying there. And the reality is that we have an enemy that does not play fair or by the rules. He does not like to play fair or by the rules, because that doesn't always work. Right? He likes to play tricky, deceitfully, and he likes to play in ways that are scheming, things that are kind of, you know, someone that just sits there and plots every single way that he can find to kind of trip you up is what the intent of that means. And what God is saying here is, put on the armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. Now, 12 is key. "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities and against powers and against the rulers of the darkness of this age, and against spiritual hosts of wickedness in heavenly places." Right? And that is a key scripture because it sets the tone for things. Now, when it says we do not wrestle, as a Christian, this is an important concept, because when you become a Christian, the rules change for you. Okay? When you start and when your mind is open and you're baptized, the rules all of a sudden change. It says we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities. And all this means is that there are different spirits, there are different principalities, there's different powers, thrones, and governments. So Satan actually has a government that runs this earth, that rules this earth. You know, Christ said, you know, if Satan cast out Satan, his kingdom will not stand. He said that in his scripture, which is recognizing that there is actually a kingdom of Satan. Satan is the ruler over that. So when it's talking about principalities and powers and rulers of the darkness of this age, it's referring to that kingdom, the kingdom of Satan that he has and he has set up in this world. Now, we'll get to, you know, what God has done to kind of pluck us out of that kingdom, but this is saying that there is a spiritual kingdom, there are rulers over that, and you may think that you're wrestling against a person next to you, flesh and blood, isn't that what it's saying? We don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but we wrestle against the others. You know, a lot of times we kind of mix those two up, because when we get into situations and we get in mixes with people or situations, you know, in your neighborhood, at your school, at work, or whatever, you a lot of times just think that, you know, this is kind of just an irritation or people. Well, it could be, and most likely is, that you're not wrestling against what you see in front of your eyes, that flesh and blood, but you're actually wrestling against principalities and powers, the rulers of this, you know, age. You know, and I'm sure you'd probably say, yeah, but, you know, you can't read into everything. You can't, you know, look at every little thing that goes on and say, you know, the devil did that. You know, when somebody pulls their car out in front of you, oh, the devil's doing that. You know, am I saying that? Or, you know, what about things that happen on your job? Well, let's take a look at it. Let's take really a look at that question and see if we can answer that. Because I think we'll find, too, that when you are a Christian, the rules have changed. When you are called and your mind is open, Satan does not like that. Satan does not like that one bit. Why is that? Let's turn to Ephesians 2. Let's go to Ephesians 2. Drop back a few. So we establish, first of all, that we're not really wrestling against what you see. We're wrestling against things that we actually don't see. Well, what has happened in this process, and why is this a problem? Is Ephesians 2, verse 1 through 7. Ephesians 2, 1 through 7, in verse 1 it says, "And you he made alive, who were dead in trespasses and sins." So he's changed our condition at some point. "And once you walked according to the course of this world." So the world is going down a certain path, a certain way, you know, broad is that path, and many people are on that path. "According to the prince of the power of the air." Now here's a scripture that we've heard a lot over the years, haven't we? You know, according to the prince of the power of the air. Who is that? It describes it here. It says, "The spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience, among whom also we once conducted ourselves in the lusts of the flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath just as others." So let's kind of dissect some of what this is saying here. First of all, the prince of the power of the air basically is talking about Satan, the ruler of this world, and is describing a way that he operates. He's the prince of the power of the air, means that he's constantly, when you say the air is kind of unseen around you all the time, or, you know, in modern terms, say airwaves, right? You can say airwaves or radio waves, things that are constantly being broadcast is the way that he works. He's the prince of the power of broadcasting or things out to this world, a continual thought, continual kind of things that he wants you to think. He's always broadcasting things like moods, emotions. He's broadcasting things that pull at your flesh. But he's constantly sending these signals out. He's the prince of the power of the air. He controls these things, right? And what are the things that he sends out? You know, I think you could probably identify that if you look close to that. He's just constantly sending out certain things, right? He's sending out lusts of the flesh. You know, what are those? Those are things like, you know, lusts of the flesh are things like anger. Right, that's something that pulls at your flesh. It's something that your flesh kind of craves, doesn't it, sometimes? Isn't it great to handle a situation with anger? Because you just get charged up and you get energized, right? And you're just going to go solve it. You're going to get mad and worked up. You know what? He's constantly broadcasting that to pull on your flesh and that kind of tendency that we have. He's also broadcasting other lusts of the flesh, you know, sex. You could see that. Pornography is all over the place. You know, on TV, movies, everywhere. He's constantly tugging at that. Lust of the eyes is another thing that he broadcasts on. You know, that's the stuff that we, you know, want, things. Isn't it always, it's never enough to have what you have, right? I know this sounds obvious, but if you really look at it, it's just never enough. And plus, what you have after a while kind of wears down, doesn't it? You need a new one. It's a never-ending cycle that, you know, wants us to kind of look at and see things that we actually don't have. And another thing he broadcasts on is the pride of life. Pride, you know, status. Have you ever seen this? I've seen this even with kids sometimes, right? Some kids, when they get into a group, somebody has to be the boss. Somebody has to establish their dominance over, you know, the other kids. And that can start even young, and you play this kind of game of who can control who or who has the power in these little cliques. You know, pride and status. One of the biggest places you see this, I don't know if you've ever been through Nordstrom, but one of the places, go through Nordstrom's, you know, makeup place, when they have all the makeup. I just think it's funny. There is nothing but a huge amount of cattiness bottled up in there. I just see these kind of, you know, there's the Lancome people and, you know, the other Estee Lauder people over here, and they're kind of, you know, eyeing each other and who's made up a certain way. And as you walk by, it's kind of like, you're quite, you know, you're a little frumpy. You're not quite up to it, you know. You just kind of, you walk through there and all of a sudden you're like, I just don't live up to any of this. I live up to none of it, you know, and they're kind of pulling you into this. But I just think that whole Nordstrom makeup place is this huge battleground for this whole status and pride, you know, type of thing. I kind of make light of it, but it's kind of funny when you walk through there. I just think it's hilarious to see that place. So you see what's happening is that Satan's constantly broadcasting out, you know, these type of things just to pull on us, constantly pull on us. But what's happened here is up there in verse 3, you know, it says we once conducted ourselves that way. Well, what do you mean once? Well, what has happened is found starting in verse 4. It says, but God, who is rich in mercy because of his great love with which he loved us, even when we were dead in trespasses, made us alive. So he's made us alive together with Christ. By grace you've been saved, and he's raised us up together and made us sit together in heavenly places in Jesus Christ. Now, he's changed the situation, saying that that is how we used to also walk, naturally. But he's changed it by picking us up and making us sit somewhere else. Where does it say we're sitting? We're sitting together with Christ in heavenly places. He's put us in another kingdom. When? When it comes? No, now. He's saying that I plucked you out of the kingdom that Satan has here, and I'm making you sit inside of another kingdom. There's the kingdom of God that we are now sitting in. We represent it. We're still here on the earth. We're still here, you know, what it looks like from the day before you got baptized to the day after. You know, all the situation physically looks the same, doesn't it? But spiritually, it completely has changed. You are now sitting in a different kingdom that's in a heavenly place. It's totally different. Now, we are no longer, you know, walking according to the lust and those things. But he's put us in a different place and made us sit in heavenly places. That is why it's a problem. Why is that? Because somebody has come in and robbed something out from Satan's nose. Satan had a grip on people. Look how he has a grip on people in this world. At will, has a grip on the ways and methods. Christ has come in and plucked them right out from his nose and said, I'm taking these people and they are now here under my jurisdiction. Satan does not like that. And you see in other places, like in Revelation, it says he's the accuser of the brethren. He accuses his people day and night. This is something that he is not happy about. The brethren are those who are called. So Satan is not happy that this situation has been changed like this. So what has he done? It says that Satan has been cast down to earth, you know, and he has great wrath because he knows he has a short time. So he is on a war path. And when it says we're not wrestling against flesh and blood, it means that there is this spiritual dimension of being plucked out of one, put into another. Satan does not like that, and he is trying to make war with it. That is actually going on. Now, I bring this up and say this because this is happening behind the scenes to things that you may be experiencing day to day. Now, can you read into everything? I don't know. We'll have to think about that. We'll have to take a look at that. Right? We'll have to take a look at that. Now, if we say, well, we're in this new kingdom, well, you know, we're no longer under the influence, right? Since we're under God's kingdom, are we still under the influence of Satan? Well, why is it true that we still are? Why is it true that we still get subject to, you know, these pulls and lusts and things of the flesh? Well, there's a couple of reasons. One, and it's the topic of this sermon, is that I don't think sometimes we recognize the way he works on us or the way he pulls on us, his devices, his thoughts, and his methods that he is doing to us. We don't always recognize. So when Paul says, you know, that we are aware of his devices, let's make sure we are. That's number one. The first step is to be aware of how these things transpire and to take place. And then the second reason is God has given us tools to do battle and to be protected and to remain under the power of his kingdom. But you know what? It's when we don't use those tools and methods. What happens? I know this happens because it happens with me. You see these physical things that happen in front of your very eyes, and you have a physical, normal reaction of the way you handle things, don't you? You have a methodology that you've developed over time to kind of deal with problems. Well, guess what? Do you have the same problem for umpteen years? Have you been hitting your head against a brick wall and with the same results? Is it the same thing? Same thing over and over and over. If that's the case, you may be fighting a spiritual battle with physical tools. So when it says we don't wrestle against the physical things, but we wrestle against spiritual things, we get those mixed up. We see the physical and we use physical tools. Guess what? Satan wants us to be in that position. He's probably laughing. Ha-ha, they don't even recognize, you know, that this is a spiritual thing happening here. And look at them flounder. Look at them flounder and flounder again and again and again and again. But it's when we recognize the devices that he's using on us and we employ the tools that God has given to us is when, because he's given us the tools to overcome. He's given us what we need to overcome. That's not the problem. It's us recognizing them and then enacting and using those tools. And what we'll find is, as we step through some of these, because I'll show you some of the ways that Satan does and things that he does to us, and then the tools are the antidote to them, you'll see it's not a way you would normally think. It's not a way that you'd probably normally react to things, right? So let's notice a couple of things. The first part or thing to notice is found in Luke 22, and this is very, very important because this is just reiterates what I was just saying. Luke 22, verse 31. The first thing to notice is that we can't stand on our own power. Simple statement? Yes. But let's look at this. Luke 22, verse 31 through 34. Luke 22. You probably remember this story, right? This is a very common story. It says, and the Lord said to, this is to Peter, right? He was saying to Peter before he was crucified, he said, Simon, Simon, indeed, Satan has asked for you that he may sift you as wheat, but I have prayed for you that your faith should not fail, and when you have returned to me, strengthen your brethren. What did Peter say? But he said unto him, Lord, I am ready to go with you both to prison and to death. Right? That's what sounds like a pretty noble statement, doesn't it? Sounds pretty good. You know, Peter is so confident in his zeal. He's so confident in his enthusiasm, and he's set his jaw. He's convicted. I will go to you with you to death. What happened? What happened here? What exactly happened? He's so determined. But you know what? What's Christ saying to him up front? What did he say to them in those first verses? He's saying that Satan has asked for you that he may sift you like wheat. He's saying, Peter, this is a spiritual battle. Satan's asked for you. What is Peter reacting to? I'm going to go do it. You know, I've got it. I'm going to just convict and I'm going to be so strong and do it. Isn't that what he's saying? He's fighting a spiritual battle with a physical tool, is what he did. Christ pointed out to him right at the beginning that this is a spiritual battle. And Christ said, I will pray for your faith that it may not fail. So he pointed that out, you know, right off. You know, Peter, he's a great guy. Although, you know, a good guy, got great ability. That's why, you know, Christ picked him for certain capabilities. But Peter had a lot to learn in this. So let's keep going down there. What happened? Right? And then Christ says in verse 34, he says, I tell you, Peter, the rooster shall not crow this day before you will deny me three times that you even know me. Boy, Peter did not like to hear that because he was, you know, there. He was not going to do this or let this happen. So starting, let's drop all the way down to verse 54. And you can see Peter fighting a spiritual battle with a physical tool. What happened? Verse 54, having arrested him, they led him and brought him into the high priest's house, but Peter followed at a distance. You know, he's kind of hanging behind. Now when they had kindled a fire in the midst of the courtyard and sat down together, Peter sat among them, and a certain servant girl, seeing him and sat by the fire, looked at him, you know, intently and said, you know, you were with him, weren't you? But he denied him, said, woman, I don't know him. I don't know him. I mean, this must have been some pretty intense situation here, right? Christ being led in this mob kind of atmosphere. I think Peter got a little scared all of a sudden. And after a while, in verse 58, you know, another saw him and said, you know, you're also one of them, aren't you? Peter said, man, I am not. Man, what are you talking about, is what he said. You know, that's what he said, man, I am not. Man, what are you talking about, right? In verse 59, he said, then after an hour had passed, another confidently affirmed, saying, surely this fellow was with him, for he is a Galilean. But Peter said, man, I do not know what you are saying. And what are you talking about? And immediately while he was still speaking, the rooster crowed. And Christ turned and looked at Peter. That's all he needed to do. Peter, I told you this is a spiritual battle. up front. And then Peter remembered the words of the Lord and how he said, "And before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times." So Peter went out and he wept bitterly. You know, this is a realization of a number of things. And, you know, Christ did this, you know, to show him, you know, what was going on. But this is a realization that he did not have the spiritual strength in this case to stand up. He was not doing this on spiritual terms, and he did not have the spiritual strength to stand up. You know, but that was a bitter pill for him to swallow because he thought he was all that and everything else. Right? He thought he was the big, strong leader. But on a spiritual dimension, he will fail unless he uses spiritual tools. Now, we're going to read a lot from Peter. Why? Because he learned this lesson. Right? I'm going to read some scriptures later that come from Peter, and Peter talks about the spiritual battle and overcoming it in great detail. So it's an amazing thing as you see this process happen that, you know, what... thanks. So when you see this process happen, Peter learned this over time. But you know, when he faced his Creator, and that's all you need to do, is when you face your Creator and you really look at Christ in the eyes, that's what Christ did here, he looked at him, you realize that you don't have the strength. That's an important thing to realize. That's an important foundational thing throughout this whole discussion to realize, is to first acknowledge, you know what, I don't have the strength by myself to do this. Right? So, I think, and what I'm proposing to you today, is that probably more often than not, we fall back to the physical tools. Now, how can you know that you're falling back to the physical tools? Well, I can tell you from experience that what happens in some of these cases is that you probably end up beating your head against the wall so much and for so long that you end up in a state maybe of burnout. Have you gotten so fed up with the situation that just won't change and seems to be the same thing over and over again that you just become exhausted? Well, sometimes those emotions and things are just signs to point and help us to understand there's a deeper issue there to think about, to work on. And I think sometimes the burnout, you know, that we may get into could be, and I'm not saying it's every single time, right? But I think we should look at that and say, think about it. Think about when you get to a stage where you just don't feel like going on and you just want to give it up, that maybe you've been fighting a spiritual battle as a Christian with your physical methods. You know, what are physical methods? I can relate to this at work. You think, well, that's work. Everybody works. That's nothing new. But wait, I said when you're a Christian, the game has changed. The game has changed. Well, you can't read into everything. Well, no, you can't read into everything, but guess what? You do have to look with spiritual glasses because Satan will use all the events around you to manipulate and do things to you. That's a true statement when you're a Christian. He's not happy that you're now part of another kingdom. Not happy at all about that. So if you find yourself being, you know, grounded to the ground, you know, there's a statement that says Satan will wear down the saints. Satan will wear down the saints. That's what it's talking about, grinding them into the ground. And guess what? If they never realize that he is behind that, wearing them down, and they're doing it with physical tools, they will get worn down and burnt out. That's exactly what those scriptures are saying. So it's important to understand this. But, you know, we might say, but, you know, God will understand when I fall because I'm physical. After all, it's Satan doing it to me. You know, I'm just a human. Satan's doing this. Satan, you know, I'm the weak one. Can you use that reasoning? Can you say, you know, the devil made me do it? It's kind of a joke. Oh, the devil made me do it. Is that valid reasoning or thinking? I think we actually have that in our mind. Let's see. The Bible addresses that. 1 Chronicles 21. 1 Chronicles 21. Can you say, the devil made me do it? Is it an excuse that you can hang your hat on and say, well, I'm mostly a good Christian except for when that Satan guy comes in and trips me up? Let's answer that question. 1 Chronicles 21, verse 1. I won't read the whole story. It's one we're familiar with, and I won't go into all of the nuances of the story, but there's an important few things to call out in this story. If you remember what's going on here, this is the time when David numbered Israel, right? 1 Chronicles 21, verse 1. What does it say in the first verse? Now Satan stood up against Israel, and he moved David to number Israel. The devil made him do it. That's exactly what that says. The devil made David do it. He stood up, stirred up against Israel, and moved David, manipulated David into doing this. And what happens in this story? Verse 2, so David said to Joab and the leaders of the people, go number Israel from Beersheba to Dan and bring the number of them to me that I may know it. In verse 3, and Joab answered said, may the Lord make his people 100 times more than they are. But my lord the king, are they not all my lord's servants? Why does the Lord require this thing? And why should there be a cause of guilt on Israel? What's the problem here? Without going into too deep, basically, David's taking a census of the people for the wrong reasons. Now, it indicates, and you'll see through these verses, that it was to number the strength of the people, because it says, when he numbered them, it says, here's how many people bear the sword, you know, have an arm for the sword. In other words, David is, what's he doing? What's he doing going into his physical battles? Are they physical battles? Was Israel and what David was doing fighting other people a physical thing? I think these scriptures point this out so clearly, is that it wasn't. He was numbering them so he could look at the physical. How many people do I have that can fight? You know, Joab says, may he make his people 100 times more than they. May he make them huge. No, don't worry about that. God will make them increase their strength and make the people you have be 100 times even more strong than the other people's, what Joab is saying to him. He's kind of bouncing it back to David saying, look, don't look at that physical. God is the one who will fight the battles here. So David's saying, I want to number the people. It's for the wrong reason. David wanted to know because he started to look at it on a physical level, didn't he? These battles were looked at on a physical level. Verse 4, nevertheless, the king's words prevailed against Joab. Now, David here was being incredibly manipulated and incredibly stubborn. That's kind of what these verses means. You know, the king's words prevailed. He finally got to the point where he said, Joab, people, I am king. Go do, right? Kind of a, I am in authority. Now you go do this. And his words prevailed. Now think about that the next time you find yourself getting super stubborn and dig your heels in on something. You may think you're right, but could it be the same situation here where you're being manipulated? Right? So what happened? If we continue on in verse 4, therefore Joab departed, went through all Israel, came to Jerusalem. Joab gave the sum of the number of the people to David. And Israel had 1,100,000 men who drew the sword. Again, how many people I have who can fight? And Judah had 470,000 men who drew the sword. But he did not count Levi and Benjamin among them, for the king's word was abominable to Joab. Joab did it anyway, but he just detested what was going on. And what happened? Did God like this? 7. God was displeased with this thing, for therefore he struck Israel. So David said to God, I've sinned greatly because I've done this thing, but now I pray take away the iniquity of your servant, for I've done very foolishly. Then the Lord spoke to Gad, David's seer, saying, go and tell David, thus says the Lord, I offer you 3 things. Choose one of them for yourselves that I may do it to you. So I'm not going to continue on in that entire story, but the rest of the story is that God is teaching David an important lesson here. And he's driving that point home. Why? Because the story, number one, is telling us that even though, verse 1 says, Satan moved him to do it and causes us to sin, God does not accept that. We must take responsibility. Quite simply, even if somebody is manipulating you, you are responsible for your reaction. God is saying that in these scriptures. David, I can't hold you responsible. He's telling David that there's no excuse. 0. I've given you enough tools for this not to happen. There is no excuse. Wow. You know, this was a bitter thing for David to learn, wasn't it? As you read down the scriptures. He was distraught at this. He begged for mercy. But God, more importantly, had to help him understand what the principle is behind this right here. Even though he was manipulated by Satan, David was responsible. Who did it affect? It wasn't just David. This wasn't a one-on-one thing. Israel got affected by this. That's another double blow that David had to learn. Even though Satan made him do it, not acceptable. And it's going to affect others. Now, that is so important for us to understand, that you cannot put the blame somewhere else, no matter what. I bet you in everything that happens, you could find a reason why it's something out there. Somebody's doing something to you. And you know what? Most of those times when somebody's doing something to you, it's true. They're doing something to you. Aren't they? I'd say that's true. God is saying, not good enough. You are responsible for your reaction. You are always responsible. Doesn't matter how much somebody manipulates you, Satan, the situation, causes you to get stirred up, you are responsible for your reaction. This is true in marriage too. You know, you get in an argument, somebody, you know, just knows exactly where to stick it in the rib, right? And then you react. Well, you did that, and nope, not acceptable. God is saying, doesn't matter what somebody does to you, especially Satan, you are responsible for this. The huge point to get out of that is you are responsible for your reaction to the situation no matter what. Hugely responsible. Satan would love for you to blame him. That's what he wants. Come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. You know, put it off on me, put it off on me. He would love that. He's more than happy for that to happen. God is saying, you notice that God never even brought up that subject to him. Never even said, well, Satan did this, I understand. It must be hard being David. You know, you're kind of flesh and king. I understand. You know, I'll help you feel better. Not happening here, was it? Right? God was saying, buddy, time for you to wake up. That's what he said to him here. Right? So taking responsibility is at core of this message. Now, the punishment, though, jolted him to the fact of a couple of things. That he had drifted so that he was looking at these battles on a physical level. That's the other lesson in this story. Those physical battles were not physical back then. They were spiritual. What? Those were spiritual battles. Why? Because God either helped them to win or he was not with them. It didn't matter how many people were there, did it? As was said in the sermonette, the name Gideon came up. The point is proven with Gideon that it can be done with a tiny army because it's not the army. It's God doing it. David's saying, I've got this huge army and I can outnumber them. God is saying, uh-uh, not going to happen. Right? That's the point and the lesson of these things. So clear. David had to get jolted back into that thinking on a spiritual level where it hurt. It hurt him to go through this type of thing. So, it's important for us to understand that we can never place blame on anyone else, even if it's a legitimate thing that somebody's done to us, and Satan will do things to us. You take responsibility for your reaction. Very important. And that we must look at it on a spiritual level. So, with the time remaining, let's go through two or three different ways that his wiles or his methods that he uses on us. Right? So what are some of these methods that he uses on us? What are some of the things that he does to manipulate us? Well, the first one that I want to cover is he manipulates our senses and our emotions. I kind of covered a little bit of this, but let's understand this a little bit deeper, why it's a problem. Let's turn to Ephesians 4, verse 25. Ephesians 4, verse 25. So Satan will manipulate our senses and our emotions. Remember, he's the prince of the power of the air, right? Ephesians 4, 25, and we'll cover through 32. It says, therefore, put away lying. Let each one of you speak the truth to his neighbor, for we are members of one another. Be angry and do not sin. Isn't that a pull of the flesh? Isn't that a something that we all experience? It says, there's a proper place for emotions. Be angry, but don't sin. Don't let the sun go down on your wrath, nor give place to the devil. There's a principle that's brought out there that's very important. It is saying, yes, there's a place for emotions, proper handling of them, but if you ride them and keep riding them and not give them up, you're opening a door for Satan. It says, don't let the sun go down on your wrath, nor give place to the devil. Don't give a place for him. One of the ways that he starts to kind of get in there is when we do that, when we have these outbursts of wrath and anger, and they're continuous and nonstop, become part of our lives. These type of things leave a door open where Satan can come in and say, you know what? That person has a tendency to get mad. What's he going to do to you? He's going to make things around you and your environment make you mad all the time. It's like you're walking around with a big red button, huge red button. It's like, push, you know, and it's just like kind of Pavlov's dog. You know, it's a stimulus reaction every single time. That's what he's saying here is, you know, if you're a person who has great wrath and things like that, you've got a big red button on you. Satan's going to push it, guaranteed. What did I say in the beginning? He's wily, crafty. He'll find a way. So let's keep going. Verse 28, let him who stole steal no longer, but rather let him labor, working with his hands what is good, that he may have something to give to him who has need. Let no corrupt word proceed out of your mouth, for what is good for necessary edification, that it may impart grace to the hearers. Don't grieve the Holy Spirit of God, by whom you were sealed for the day of redemption. Right? Let all bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, evil speaking be put away with you with all malice. Be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God in Christ forgave you. So the spiritual antidote is listed there as well. Right? Well, sometimes we think, you know, being kind and tender-hearted and forgiving others, those are nice to have Christian values, right? You know, when I get around to them, after I've been angry with them for a week, and I get around to it, I'll forgive them, right? That's an antidote here. That's the antidote to the other things. When you have the bitterness, the wrath, you have a wide open door that Satan just keeps pressing your buttons. If you forgive, and you're really tender-hearted, from your heart. Now, you and I know that we can do something and bite our tongues, can't we? On the outside, we can bite our tongues. Somebody says something to us, I'm not going to react. You know, you put on a big smile, and the outside is put together. That's not what it's saying here, right? When you're tender-hearted in your heart, and you forgive each other as Christ forgave you, even when they're in their sins, that's from the heart. You can't fake that. That's different. So when we bite our tongues and not react, we're not there yet. It's not what it's talking about. That won't get you anywhere, because there will be a time where something will make you blow up. I guarantee you. You can only bite your tongue for so long before you explode, right? Christ gives us a real solution that lasts and that works. Now, it also talks about these are natural pools of the flesh. These are things that naturally happen to us. Now, and have you ever seen somebody with one of these weaknesses that keeps getting their button pressed? You know, someone who, for example, can't keep their eyes off of a girl. Have you ever seen this? Pretty girl walks by, can just lead that person around the room by their nose. They have no idea what they're doing. Huh? You know, that's exactly what it's saying. There's no control over these pulls that you have on you so that you can be manipulated. You can easily be manipulated. Same thing is true of money and power. You know, some people are so enamored with the concept of power, they get around power, their knees start quivering and they have no idea who they are. And they just kind of goes out the window and they kind of walk around like a salivating dog following this person around, right? It's kind of this, you lose control of yourself. You have no control over this kind of, wow, that's amazing, right? And Satan can take advantage of these things. Satan can use these things to manipulate you and cause you to, you know, to sin. This is actually a very important reason why it's such a critical thing in child rearing to teach your children emotional control. Why? Because you're going to set them up for a good spiritual foundation. Right? This is important because if your kids have no concept of boundaries and how to control themselves, things will come along to manipulate them and kind of take them off course. You're giving them a good foundation if you help them to understand what it means to control those things. I did not say stuff every emotion down, quit crying or quit doing this or quit, you know, that, and just stuff it down and make you kind of conform. I said you teach them to learn to control their emotions properly. That's a critical thing for child rearing to understand, because you're setting them up for when they are called to be able to understand the principle here of doing the spiritual battle. So think about that. You know, we always think in lack of this emotional control and being manipulated is a problem, why we have a problem understanding concepts like love and faith. Because love is not a feeling. We're always looking for a feeling. Faith is not a feeling. We're always looking for a feeling. You know, I just feel like I have strength today. It's not what faith is. It's not what love is. Agape love is loving despite what you feel. Agape love to your partner and your mate is, even though you don't feel like it, you do it. There's a difference. The feeling will follow that, for sure, but it's not the other way around. Same with faith. I feel like I have faith today. No, if you don't feel like you have faith today, you pray, you believe what God says, and you move, even though you have those feelings. It's despite the feelings is what it is. So this is a very important concept here, and I bring this up because Satan, if you have those emotional weaknesses, he'll manipulate, come in, and he can control you with those things. So think about that. Think about examples in the Bible. Judas Iscariot had a weakness for money, one of the things. right? Balaam had a huge weakness for money. It's almost a comical story where they wanted him to go curse Israel for money, and he was just so mixed. But boy, he was getting manipulated all over the place, wasn't he? It's just it's a funny story. Cain, his anger. God said, you know, why are you angry? Why is your countenance falling? If you do well, will you not be accepted? If you do not do well, sin lies at the door. Its desire is for you, but you should rule over it. That's exactly what he's telling him there. If you don't get a grip on that, it's going to rule you, but you should rule over it. Scribes and Pharisees love power so much in position that when the actual Christ was sitting in front of them doing miracles, couldn't see it. It rocked their little power structure. Solomon, women, lust, totally corrupted him. So there is a way that we'll find that Satan does work. He does work through these things in people to kind of do, to manipulate us. Now, let me give you one kind of example of a way that he's worked through the ages that always works, because I guarantee you probably recognize this. Turn over to 1 Peter 2:19. This way works every time. It's when you are wronged. Something is done wrong to you. It's worked on the angels and people throughout all history. 1 Peter 2, verse 19. You know what? You may be completely in the right. Let me just say that all these situations are, you may be completely in the right, but you're wronged, is when it happens. 1 Peter 2:19. For this is commendable if, because of conscience towards God, one endures grief, suffering wrongfully. That's saying that it's going to happen and you're going to suffer. But it's a good thing if you say, this is, you know, I understand the principle of this and I'm going to take this wrongfully. For what credit is it if you are beaten for your faults, you take it patiently? But when you do good and suffer, if you take it patiently, this is commendable before God. For to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow his steps, who committed no sin nor deceit was found in his mouth. For when he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he didn't threaten, but he committed himself to him who judges righteously. So one of the first things to understand here is it says when you're beaten for your faults, sometimes, you know, you have to ask yourself when you're in one of these situations, first off, you can't say, oh, you know, you can't go make somebody mad and then said, Satan's doing that to me, right? This is saying if you're, the principle here is if you're doing it and you're beaten for your faults, that's, you're not suffering, you caused it in a lot of ways. So the first question to ask yourself when you're in one of these situations is to always examine yourself. Always say, look, am I not acting with wisdom here? And I would guarantee probably sometimes we don't. We don't act with wisdom and we don't kind of put out, you know, something. So the first thing to do is to not immediately say it's Satan, but ask ourselves, am I acting with wisdom? Is it me? I don't want to be beaten for my faults. Now, if you've gone to God, prayed, and examined it, and it doesn't look that way, you know, then maybe it is a thing that's set up and that you are suffering wrongfully, right, if you've examined yourself. And again, what it's saying here is it's not a matter of biting your tongue, and I'd like to put that out to you that we probably do that a little too much, just control the outside. Christ does not give us that recipe. Christ gives us a completely different recipe here, because if you just bite your tongue, at some point you will boil over. But what he's saying here is, first of all, Christ set the example. In other words, Christ's not asking you to do something that he didn't do first. He did this. He lived this way of life, and he set the example so that we may do it. So he's not asking you to do something that he didn't do himself. What he's saying here is that when you suffer wrong, he committed himself to him who judges righteously. He left it in God's hands. So when you do that, that's a different thing. That's saying, I know what, this thing is wrong, it's giving me heartburn, but I'm going to go to God and say, God, you understand and you know how to judge this situation righteously. I leave it to you. I forgive, and it's now in your hands. That's what the pattern or the thing that God, you know, Christ left us to do there. What happens there? I've seen this happen when you actually let go and you leave it in God's hands, that God sometimes will work that situation out for you. He will cause those people who are doing it to fail, to fall on their face. In other words, he says, I'm going to pass a judgment here. This is not right, and I'm going to rectify it. He doesn't always rectify things. He may save it for the great, you know, the judgment day, the great white throne judgment. He may bring, you know, call those things into account. But I have seen it where he does judge today, and he does act on your behalf for you. But not until you've left it in his hands and you have forgiven. Now, why is it that Christians don't gloat when something happens to them? Because you've already forgiven. In fact, Job prayed for his friends because he had already forgiven them. So he leaves us a recipe here. And just want to point that out, that is something that I think is a way that he gets to people time and time again down through the ages. When there is a wrong, injustice, something done to you, the answers are there. So let's just cover one more. The last one probably deserves a sermon on its own. The second one of the tools that he uses us today, I think this is particularly relevant today, is he overwhelms us with things in life so that it chokes out his word. He overwhelms you. Turn to Mark 4, verse 1 through 20. Here's a parable, you know, that we've read a lot of times, but I like to call out one section of it. Mark 4, verse 1 through 20. Right, he started to teach them this parable of the sower. Mark 4, verse 3 says, "Listen, behold, a sower went out to sow. When it happened, he sowed that some of the seed fell by the wayside. The birds of the air came and devoured it. Some fell on stony ground, didn't have much earth, and immediately sprang up because it had no depth of earth. But when the sun was up, it was scorched because it had no root and it withered away." Verse 7, "And some seed fell among the thorns, and the thorns grew up and choked it, and it yielded no crop. But other seed fell on good ground and yielded a crop that sprang up, increased and produced, some 30-fold, 60, and some 100-fold." Right? And then what happened is later in verse 10, his disciples came to him and he said, you know, can you explain this parable to us? You know, what does this mean? And so he started to, you know, go through a number of things. But dropping down in verse 13, he kind of gives the interpretation of what's going on here. He says, "Do you not understand this parable? How then will you understand the other parables? The sower sows the word, and there are the ones by the wayside where the word is sown. When they hear, Satan comes immediately and takes away the word that was sown in their hearts." So first of all, he's setting the context that there is a spiritual battle here. Satan is doing some work here. "And these likewise are the ones sown on stony ground, who when they heard the word, immediately received it with gladness, and they had no root in themselves, and they only endured for a time. And afterwards, when there was tribulation or persecution arises for the word's sake, immediately they stumble." You know, up until that point, if you look at that, ask yourself the question, out of all of these descriptions, which one do you think would match closest to you? I would say, you know, most people, we've probably been through some sort of persecution or tribulation and had to hang on to the truth. And maybe that doesn't necessarily apply to us. So, you know, obviously there's going to be a time where it's worse. But what I'm saying is, of all these things, what do you think is the most dangerous thing to you? Because it doesn't matter how it happens, the end result's the same. It doesn't matter the process, the same thing. Well, verse 18, I'm sorry. "So now the ones that were sown among thorns, they are the ones who hear the word, and the cares of this world, the deceitfulness of riches, and the desires for other things entering in choke the word, and it becomes unfruitful." In my opinion, in looking at what goes on in life, I think that that is probably one of the biggest dangers that we face today. You know, how many of you have things that are just completely overwhelming? The demands of life. Now, I'm not talking about things that are not unnecessary either, am I? There's a lot of things, cares of this world. There's emails you have to answer. You get phone calls. You have to shuttle your kids around. You have to go to work. You have to pay the bills. Your grass is growing larger, so you have to cut the grass. You have to clean the dog. You have to clean the kids. You have to clean the yard. You have to clean basically everything in the world. Shopping for food. Cleaning the house. Oh, I got to fix the food. Well, I just fixed lunch. Now I got to fix dinner. Are not all of these things actually real things? I didn't point out anything that is not something that's necessary for us to get along in life. Have you ever stopped and said, "Man, I am so busy, but I have no idea what I've done"? You ever said that? I say it all the time. I'm like, what am I doing? What am I doing in life? I have just exhausted myself, and I have no idea what I did. No idea what I accomplished. You know why? Because there's a lot of these things that are at play here. Those are cares of this world. Another thing he mentions here is deceitfulness of riches. Working so hard to get the extra money, right? Once I get to the place where I have enough money and we have a big house and enough land and my cars are paid off and blah, 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 I'll have arrived. Not true. Never will happen. Once you get to that place, those cars are now 10 years old and you need a new one, right? There's just this cycle that doesn't stop, right? You actually, if you think about it, you're kidding yourself, but don't realize it. There's this deceitfulness there of riches. desires for other stuff, it says here. Stuff, just stuff, right? The next level in your job, the bigger house, car, clothes, stuff. Right? These are things that pull on us. And this is not describing something that's out of the ordinary. I think this happens to us all. That's why I say I think that this is a huge thing that Satan uses today. I've never been more overwhelmed in my life than ever with the amount of things going on. Right? There is no time to stop and to think. You know, with all the stuff I have going on, I end up getting my sermons, most of my work done from like 11 p.m. to 2 a.m., you know, at night. And I'm just like, wait a second. There's so much going on and that there's no quiet time to think, is there? There's no peaceful time to think. Well, that's a problem. Because what it says here is those things surrounding you will choke out the word. It doesn't matter how it happens, the end result's the same. That word gets squeezed until it has no room. You have no room to think about it. There's no room to work on it. No room for it to grow 20, 30, 60 fold, is there? This is reality of life. What do you do about it? Everybody has to live in life now. Everybody has 1,000 demands more than they had last year. What do you do? Luke 10, there's an answer here. Luke 10, verse 38. Luke 10, verse 38. Very interesting little story, but it's written for our time today. Luke 10, verse 38 through 42. It says, now as it happened as they went, that he entered a certain village, and a certain woman named Martha welcomed him to her house, and she had a sister called Mary, you know, who also sat at Jesus' feet, and he heard his word. So one of the sisters is sitting there listening to the word, but, verse 40, Martha was distracted with much serving. Right? What is she doing? She's doing those things that you should do when somebody visits your house, isn't she? She's preparing the food and the plates and making sure that the floor is swept and all those things that are necessary, aren't they? You know what? And her other sister's just sitting there listening to Christ. Wow, that made her mad, right? She approached him and said, Lord, you know, don't you care that my sister has left me to do this all by myself? You know, tell her to help me. You know, I don't like this. What did Jesus say to her? Right, this is the answer. Jesus said to her, Martha, Martha, you're worried and troubled about so many things. But one thing is needed, and Mary has chosen that good part which will not be taken away from her. Right, it's a simple story, but it says so much. It says so much, because those things are necessary, preparing food and things like that. But the answer is that you must choose. You have to choose. You know what I found is you just cannot do it all. Well, does that sound obvious? You can't do it all. What it's saying is that you're going to have to drop something. But I can't. Well, you better. You're going to have to find something that you're going to have to let slip. Because you have to choose what? You have to choose the one thing that's needed, the good part, and the thing that won't be taken away from you. If you do not, you do not choose that, it will be choked out. Evaluate your life. Is there something there that's just completely overwhelming necessary? Can you do it a different way? Can you not clean your house for 2 days? I cringe at saying that because I know how hard that can be. Can you devote some study and then maybe do it every third day? I don't know. I'm just throwing things out. I'm not saying that's the right pattern. But you're going to have to choose. And you have to make that choice, because if you do not, the word will be choked out by all those things. Satan will find so many things for you to do that are all important. It's that simple. Decide what you're going to drop and choose the necessary thing that won't be taken away from you. So let me skip the last one. I'll come back to that someday, but the last thing that he works on in our minds, which I'll just say to you, is fiery darts and strongholds that lodge in our minds. And that deserves a sermon on its own someday. So let's conclude the matter. Let me scroll way down. Let's turn to the last scripture, 1 Peter 5. 1 Peter 5:5. You know, and this sums it up. I obviously didn't cover all wiles of the devil. I didn't cover all tools. I didn't cover all things. But I just wanted to point out a few of the basic principles to get in our thinking and our minds. And there's a lot of scriptures you can read that talk about his methods and give you tools to do them. But this is the end result. This gives you one of the biggest tools, and this also gives you the end result of what God is doing. Even though those things happen to you, and it sounds like it's just, you're a Christian, these things are going to happen to you. God is in them. There's something that he's doing there. You know, and you'll see it, the pattern of like Job, if you ever go back and read Job, that Satan comes along, but God allows certain things, and the end result of Job was an amazing thing. Something worth more than money, wasn't it? And that's what these scriptures are saying here. 1 Peter 5, 5 through 10. It says, likewise, you younger people, submit yourself to the elders. Yes, all of you be submissive to one another and be clothed in humility. For God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Therefore, humble yourselves into the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time, casting your care upon him, for he cares for you. And verse 8 says, humility is an important thing there, but verse 8 also talks about, be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Now, we have to resist. It's not automatic. But we have to resist the way and with the tools that God has given us. And I explain some of those to you. And as you study, think of other tools that are spiritual, that are different in the way that he gives us. Resist him, steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world. But may the God of all grace, and you'll see the end result of this, who called us to his eternal glory by Christ Jesus, after you have suffered wrongfully, after you have suffered, what is the end result of that? Like I said, it's not a needless thing. In fact, there's a huge thing that happens in that. After you've suffered for a while, he'll perfect, he'll establish, he'll strengthen, he'll settle you. Those describe a Christian who's gone through the process, come out the other side with the spiritual tools, mature, established, understanding the ground that they are on, strengthened, and the last one, settled. The anxiousness, the anxiety, all, you know, that you get churned up about all these events, the end result that God works is that you end up settled. A peace that you can't describe during those things is what God does. So as it says up there, submit yourselves under the mighty hand of God. And this, through the process, is what you end up with. Thanks.